Of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
They think they're living in a police state.
Once upon a time, there were these people in Europe called pilgrims, and they were afraid of being persecuted. So they all got in a boat and sailed to the New World where they wouldn't have to be scared ever again.
I loves my gun,
and I don't mean no money like I work at Walmart and make no money.
So enjoy yourself, or I'll come looking for you. There and veg out in front of your TV and enjoy what these fine people are giving you, which is maximum entertainment. You understand what I'm saying about? And don't you ever, ever, ever forget what it's like without TV. Because before TV, people just sat and played with themselves all night.
I loves my gun. Loves my gun.
Recorded 26th of May, 2012. And that's International Blacksmith's Day, or so they tell me. So this episode of Rangers A to Z is going to be a weird one. This is your host, Iron Angel. I want to thank you for listening. Welcome to the show. As always, this is a free podcast. Feel free to distribute, copy it, give it to friends, do whatever you want with it. If you want to do a remix and make a dubstep version, I don't care. Have fun. Just hop on and let us know. It'd be kind of cool to hear something like that. If you're doing the Facebook thing, you can find us there at, facebook.com/Rangers, R4NGER5, dot A, the number 2, and the letter Z. That's Rangers A to Z. You can also find us, of course, at the main Rangers site, which is R4NGER5.com. Stop in there, check out some of the videos, check out the other stuff the other guys are doing, and, you know, possibly even hop into the IRC and say, hey, how's it going? You can find our IRC at irc.freenode.com. The room is #R4NGER5. That's Rangers, just like everything else. So anyway, let's get going. So the first thing you might ask yourself is how does blacksmithing and that ability really pertain to taking care of little everyday problems? The ability to make your own tools, to make field repairs and that kind of stuff is incredibly handy. Once you know how, you'll find uses for it you didn't know you had. Like anything else, if you've got some skills with rope, you'll find ways to lash things together and tie on cargo onto vehicles and so on and so forth you'd never thought about before. But the skills of the blacksmith, first of all, let's start with this one. There's a disclaimer here. This is really frickin' dangerous. You are playing with live fire. You're dealing with incredibly hot steel, up to about 2,000 degree steel. You have the potential to get hurt. Take all the safety precautions you possibly can, and you're on your own from there. The best safety precaution, obviously, is you know, a clear head, turning on your brain, using it. But hearing protection and eye protection are also really incredibly good ideas. The ringing of the hammer, all the other noises and stuff that go with it will slowly rob you of your hearing. The joke about deaf blacksmiths isn't really a joke. A lot of the guys I know are partially deaf. I've got some hearing damage. Almost everybody else I know has got some hearing damage. So definitely take care of your body. Take care of yourself. Now, that said, for entertainment purposes only, we're going to cover some of the stuff that I have done in the field. Usually, you know, everyone kind of makes this assumption of a blacksmith in a forge with a full setup, you know, all kinds of tongs and hammers and an anvil and all that kind of stuff. The reality is it started out somewhere with a guy with a hole in the ground who was probably working with copper or bronze and discovered that there was some other stuff in the fire that got hot, and you could hammer on that and make it into something else, and the first blacksmith was born. That's well lost in the sands of history and sands of time and all that sort of stuff. But Okay, I have to interject here. I'm slightly distracted today. A buddy of mine has listened to all these shows. He's a real good friend of mine. Known him for years. Hell of an inspiration. He's been helpful in teaching me a lot of the things that I relate here. Cam, if you're listening, thanks, man. He called me out. This show is in Tangentovision. I get off on tangents. I know I get off on tangents. I grew up around Indians. Tangents are basically how every story goes. So if you're out there and you're going, but you never got around to the point, yeah, sorry about that. Eventually I will. It's going to take, you know, 15 episodes. But so hopefully we won't tangent too much here, but guaranteed, we're going to. So, you know, buckle your seatbelt. We're on the Tangento Coaster. So keep your hands and feet inside the car. We're going for a ride. All right, first thing, blacksmith. What it literally means is to strike iron. Black metal being iron in its natural form. It's a very dark gray. Once it's been polished and ground and all that kind of stuff, you can get it up to a nice shine. It's a real nice kind of chromey-looking material. But in its natural form, in its raw worked form, it's a dark metal. Redsmiths work in copper, being a reddish metal, goldsmiths, silversmiths, so on and so forth. The word smith is literally to strike, one who hits things. Smithing is a process of manufacturing stuff. Some people will say, oh, you know, you're an iron forger. Well, that's not technically true. I'm not making fake iron. I don't do forgeries. But what you're doing is you're heating iron or steel. Regular raw iron is hard to come by these days. Most of what we perceive as iron is actually very mild steel. Steel is iron with some inclusions, usually carbon. And if the steel doesn't have more than 0.5% carbon, it can't be hardened. It can be surface hardened with a case hardening treatment. We'll get into that down the road a ways. And the cat's in my lap, so hang on just one second. I will be right back. I have to go feed the cat. Okay, back again. That was sort of fun. The cat came running, jumped up my lap, you know, did the, oh, you must be talking to me thing. I figured, all right, food bowl's empty. No, the cat was irritated by competition, speaking of tangents. There was a fairly large spider that had passed out in the food bowl, so had to deal with that. I live in a weird old blacksmith shop. I have some spiders. If you don't like them out there, I understand. I kind of like them because the spiders keep the flies and mosquitoes and all that sort of stuff down. So if you can tolerate them out in your garage and your garden and places like that, they do a pretty fantastic job of clearing up bugs for you. Any rate, back on where we were supposed to be. And yeah, Cam, I tangented. What you're doing is you're heating up iron, steel, what have you. And you're striking it with a hammer to try and control it into a shape you want. Now, this on paper sounds really easy. In reality, it's not particularly easy, as you'll discover if you try this. But you don't need a huge amount of expensive gear to get into this. You don't need a huge amount of expensive gear to actually be functional at this. And in a situation where you're broke down out in the middle of nowhere, having this little bit of knowledge in this show will get you hopefully headed in the right direction. I say hopefully because you really do need to practice this one quite a bit. And some people live in like an apartment or something where you've got neighbors all around you are going to have a lot of problems finding a place to hang out and practice. So if you can, you know, if you happen to be an apartment dweller and are trying to better yourself, trying to learn some skills, find some place you can go camp that you can play in fire, that, you know, or a friend's house or what have you. I warn you right now, if you try and do this in a large public campground, the ranger's going to come talk to you. They're going to get bent about this. It makes a lot of noise. It looks scary. It tends to freak out the normal folk out there. What you're going to need is some means of holding a piece of steel. Obviously some steel. Some heat, a hammer, and something to smack on. Now, obviously, all those tools are kind of big, expensive, complicated tools. But there's another way. There's always another way. If we go back to the earliest history in blacksmithing and metalwork in general, typically they were using what we call a ground forge. It has a bunch of different names. Pit forge, hole forge. All it really is a hole dug in the ground. with a trench dug away from it. The trench allows you to get air under the fire. A normal campfire isn't going to get hot enough because the air is coming in from the sides, and a typical wood campfire, a hardwood campfire, is going to burn maybe 1,400 degrees. The coals themselves are going to be warmer, but not as warm as a good coal forge fire is, where you're putting air into the fire from underneath, and the coal on top is acting as an insulator, allowing the heat to come up further. You can do this with wood, and you can actually do this... you could literally be dropped out of a plane with a few simple tools and get away with you know, finding some old steel somewhere out in the middle of nowhere and being able to make a few basic tools, a hammer, a very primitive axe, that kind of stuff, with just about nothing. You'll need some wood. Drier is certainly better. Hardwood is a whole lot better than pine. Pine has a lot of inclusions that cause it to pop and snap and throw sparks at you and that kind of stuff. Wood with any kind of moisture in it has a possibility to create steam explosions, little pops and snaps. And you know, if you've been around a campfire, you've probably seen the pops and snaps and little sparks and stuff being thrown off by a campfire. Now, is that saying you can't use a campfire? No. It's just not going to be anywhere near as efficient. If you've got, say, a 3-foot-long hunk of steel you found somewhere, probably you're going to start with rebar. I wouldn't use rebar for anything other than practicing, because rebar has a tendency to have highly variable carbon content, ranging from none whatsoever up to almost cast iron and back to none whatsoever in 6 feet. Rebar is made from every leftover hunk of crap they can find to throw in the ladle. So if you're looking at rebar going, I got some rebar all back, I'll use that. Yeah, don't use it for anything critical. Don't use it for anything important. Don't use it for anything you want to show somebody. It makes dandy little snakes. Once you learn how to make little ornamental stuff, it makes a dandy little diamondback snake. But beyond that, I wouldn't use rebar for anything other than practicing on. On the same token, don't go out and buy brand spanking new expensive high quality steel to learn on. A lot of people like old car springs. The problem with old car springs is they have a tendency to have been through a rather rough life and are full of little stress cracks and things like that that will break later. Sometimes as you're hammering, sometimes after you get the piece done. Springs are also typically a little over 0.5% carbon. You'll have to do some research online to learn what all of these weird numbers and stuff mean, but most car springs are 5160. The first two numbers in a steel's name, when it's a numerical four-digit sequence, indicate what alloy it is. 51 series is, I don't remember right now. I will have to look that up real quick. Hang on. Oh, hey, my first guess was right. This is what having a huge shelf full of books is handy for. The more books you have, the more you know. All the 50 series steels are chrome-bearing, high-carbon tool steel, or it's a spring steel. The chromium allows additional hardenability. Typically 5160 is used for high wear stuff, hard use things. It doesn't hold a particularly fine edge. The second two numbers, the 60 in there, are points of carbon. 100 points is 1%. So something like 5160 doesn't hold a particularly great edge, where 52100 will. 52100 you have all around you and don't realize it. It's 1% carbon, and it's made into ball bearings. Nice hard steel. It makes a particularly nice, if you can get a big ball bearing, it makes a really spiffy knife, you know, for skinning and for backpacking, camping, that kind of stuff. But none of these are actually a stainless steel. Stainless is exactly what it does. It doesn't rust as easily. It doesn't stain as easily. All stainless steels have a high chromium content. The problem with stainless steel is, one, it's difficult to forge. It's not a good steel to learn on. It has to be worked very hot. And it has some weird properties in it called red shorting that you will not enjoy. Don't start with stainless because it will frustrate the living crap out of you. If you can, just start with a basic simple steel like 10-10, 10-20, which you can go down to the hardware store and get as either hot roll or cold roll steel. I recommend getting hot roll. Cold roll has been basically run through rollers when it's cold, leaves it a nice, smooth, clean surface. They pickle it with acid, muriatic acid, to clean it up, make it look pretty, that kind of stuff. If you're just going to use it directly, weld it into something, you know, to make, say, a stand for your barbecue grill or something like that, it's just fine. For most of the kind of stuff we're going to be doing, basic hot roll is really the way to go. You're not paying for all that additional processing, the rolling, the cleanup, the acid washing, so on and so forth. So if you're going to buy a steel, get the cheapest crap hot roll you can find. If you go out to a scrapyard and happen to find a bunch of hot roll, snatch it up. You know, you'll pay a lot less from a scrapyard than you will from a new steel place, and you'll pay way less than you will from, say, the hardware store. When you go to the hardware store, you're paying absolute premium prices. If you go to an actual steel supply yard, you can get high-quality carbon steel for that kind of price often. So, you know, seek out those places to practice with. Obviously, in the field, you're going to use whatever you get your hands on. If you suddenly need a spike to drive into a log so you can drag the log out of the road with a chain, something like that, whatever you got laying around is going to work because it's what you have and you have no other options. Adaptability and flexibility are real important. Now, once you've figured out what you're going to use for steel, and that, you know, that could be any number of things, then you need a fire. That pit forge we discussed just in touching back early on, basically is a hole, sort of bowl-shaped, probably 12 inches across, perhaps a little bigger, or a long trench. If you're using logs that you found in the woods, say, you know, 4 to 6 inch logs you found in the woods, standing dead wood, you can lay it into the fire, build your fire, and lay the log on top, and just keep pushing the log in as it burns away. In any case, no matter how you build this forge, you're going to have the air slot coming into it. With a trench forge, it comes in at a T-gator section, a perpendicular angle. Comes in from the bottom. And you don't actually want to work in the open flame. That's not the warmest spot. You want to work in the coals. How this whole thing works is actually infrared transference of heat. The infrared heat coming off the coals is what actually heats up the steel more than the heat in the air around it. Now, unfortunately, it also radiates infrared out and around, which means that when you're standing over it trying to fan this thing with a hubcap or something like that, you're going to be getting an awful lot of heat on you. So you probably want to wear some fairly heavy clothes. I have to admit, they're calling for 93 degrees tomorrow. I'll be working in the forge tomorrow. It isn't the brightest thing in the world to do to put on extra clothes, you know, put on a heavy leather apron, put on a heavy wool shirt, and then start a fire right in front of your crotch. But, you know, that's what I do, so I don't know any better. I make these mistakes so you don't have to. Anyway, you got your fire. You can use a full-on forge. I've got a post up on my blog if you want to go look there, which is at ironangelforge.blogspot.com. You can find my blacksmithing blog there. And just search that blog for Bucket Forge. That's basically a ground forge contained in a plastic or metal bucket. Full set of drawings and stuff show you how to make that. It's something you can put in the garage, take outside in the driveway and use, and put away when you're done, so on and so forth. It's a slightly more advanced version of the same thing. You can go ahead and actually build a full-on table forge if you got room to store it, and so on and so forth. Obviously, you got to be really careful about fire safety. That's something you got to be careful with all the time. When you dig a hole, if you hit a root, dig a different hole. You don't want to catch that root on fire and have the fire run along the inside of that root and catch a tree on fire and start a forest fire and so on and so forth. That's bad. Don't do that. What we're all about is positive things, not causing mayhem and havoc and all that kind of stuff. So don't do that, eh? Obviously, you don't want a tree overhead. You don't want a whole lot of leaves and brush around you. Rake back all the brush, rake back all the leaves in the area you're going to be working about 10-15 feet back. Having some sand or water handy isn't a half bad idea either. So, you've got a fire. Now, normally we'd use a set of bellows or a crank blower or an electrical blower to drive air up underneath that fire. For a field repair, you may not have that option. What you might end up having to do for a field repair is that trench that comes out, you'll have to cover it with some bark or moss or roots, sticks, something like that, and then bury it in sand so that it allows air to move through it, but it's still somewhat shielded from the fire. You don't really want anything flammable up near the fire. If you got a couple of old tin cans, stomp flat, those work even better. And the mouth of your trench is going to come out, you know, say 18 inches or so. And the mouth of your trench opens up fairly wide into a cone shape. If you dig it that way, you can use something like a hubcap, like a pie plate, something like that, that you've got handy, just to fan it and drive some air up into the fire and increase the overall temperature. Now, obviously, if you've got some sort of a bellow system or a blower or something like that for working in the shop, great, do it. But the objective here is to teach you how to do this in an emergency situation. And we'll eventually get to stories here toward the end of cases I've had to deal with stuff like this, where this skill set actually came in handy. So anyway, you've got your air drive coming in from underneath, if at all possible. You might have to put some rocks or something like that in the bottom to keep the coals from falling down into your trench. If you get rocks, don't get rocks that have been in a river. Don't get rocks that are deeply buried in the ground. If at all possible, pick up some gravel, rocks, that kind of stuff that's been sitting on the surface, because they're generally a lot drier internally than a rock that's been encased in water and therefore won't have steam explosions tearing the rock apart and exciting the living tar out of you. In a normal forge, you've got a cast iron bowl. You've got a little, usually refractory rocker ball. And the cast iron is sufficiently thick that it doesn't have any issues with the heat setting above it. And usually there's an ash bed between the cast iron and the forge fire itself. Most smiths will keep a little bit of ash in their bowl because it helps protect it and make it last longer. Now, if you can, dig your bowl in clay, because that will last a lot longer and give you a lot less grief. You know, along a riverbank or something like that, dig out some clay, bring it up to your campsite, and line your hole with clay. Build your fire. Let it burn down until it's just coals. Keep bringing in wood and let the fire, the open flame, burn at the edge of your work area. Now, I suppose if you wanted to practice, you could actually do this in a regular campfire wherever you happen to be camping. The easy way to do that is just to rake the coals all off to one side and fan them from the top. But I can tell you from my own experience about 30 years ago, actually 30 years ago, 2 weeks ago, I had read some articles on the blacksmith shop that I actually own and live in now, and decided that looked pretty interesting and I wanted to know how to do that. So being an industrious young lad, I set about trying to come up with a feasible solution. I took our very large Weber charcoal grill, a heavy steel electric fan, and all the charcoal I could round up, plus a whole bunch of sticks and stuff, and built myself a fire out in the backyard. Fortunately, Mom wasn't home, because I'd have gotten in so much frickin' trouble for this. And this didn't end real well. Learn from my mistakes. Don't make the same stupid mistakes I did. I was driving air in from the top, putting the fan on a table next to the little steel table next to the Weber. And the fan certainly got the coals going a great deal hotter and pushed all that heat downward into the Weber itself. After about 15 minutes or so of this, I got the bottom of the Weber bright glowing orange, about 1400, 1500 degrees. At which point the little aluminum gate that allows you to adjust and let in more or less air and keep the ash from falling out melted and dropped off the bottom. Shortly thereafter, the heat had gotten sufficient that the grill that was underneath of all of that sagged from the weight of the coal sitting on top of it and the heat. And, you know, because I was a kid, I did what every kid did. Once I got the fire put out, I just covered it up and pretended it never happened. Mom came out a few days later and went, "What in the hell happened to this thing?" So, sorry, Mom. My next incarnation was a cement block forge, or attempted a cement block forge. Basically, a whole bunch of cement blocks facing into the wind, built into a cone shape to try and funnel the air. And I discovered that cement blocks explode because there's some water trapped in them. Plus, it got rained on after I had a good raging fire going. All of a sudden, we got a rain shower. I started to learn a lot more about meteorology after that. Thanks, Grandpa. He helped a lot. So you got your forge, you got your fire, you got a feasible air system, something. If you happen to come across an old hair dryer, they kind of work. Not great, but they kind of work for this sort of thing. And I will warn you, a hair dryer will overheat. If you get an old one that the coils have burned out on, perfect, as long as the fan still works. Yes, a shop vac will work. It will also blow the coal right out of your forge, no question asked. But here's a little secret trick. Any blower can only put out as much air as you put into it. And therefore, if you choke the air going into it, so it doesn't have as much air coming out of it, you'll get very good control over your airflow. You don't really need a lot. You're not trying to launch this into space or anything like that. You're just trying to get it warmer. So a minimal amount of air will make a huge difference. If you've got shorter pieces of steel, you're going to need something to hold on to them with. At first, you're going to start out, and in a emergency situation where you're going to need these skills, you're not going to have a good set of blacksmith tongs, which are basically similar to pliers with very long handles. I've seen a lot of guys use channel locks. They will work. They're not the best solution, but they're certainly better than nothing. For someone with weak hands, vice grips are definitely a very good way to go. But make sure you don't get them too warm, because vice grips are a tempered steel. It's a hardened steel. You take a high carbon steel. We'll go through that whole process in the second half or the next episode or something in there. But by drawing the temper out of them, you weaken them a great deal and make them nowhere near as useful a tool as they had been. So, you know, perhaps channel locks are your best bet to start out with if you can't get your hands on a decent set of tongs. A decent set of blacksmith's tongs are expensive, but once you start learning this, are not difficult at all to build yourself. Quite often, I'll make a set of tongs just for a given project and then leave them laying around for something else that might be vaguely like that later. Sometimes you need a special shape to hold on to something or what have you. Now you've got a way to hold on to your hot steel. You've got hot steel. You've got all your safety stuff. You've got your fire suppression equipment, all that kind of stuff. Now you need something to hit with and hit on. To hit with, most people use a hammer, one of man's oldest tools. In the field, you may not have a hammer. A large, fairly flat rock, a couple of pounds that you can fit in one hand, will work. You have to be careful, obviously, not smack your fingers in hot steel, because you get both crushed and burned at the same time. But in an emergency, if you absolutely have to fix something to get out of the situation you're in, a pretty good-sized rock will work. Hopefully you've got a couple pound smooth-faced hammer with you. Don't try and use a claw hammer. One, they're not the right shape. If you look at the hammer face very close in, you'll see that the hammer face on a claw hammer is dead flat. Sometimes they got little waffly prints. Some of them even have spikes so they catch the head of the nail and don't bend the nail over or skip off. You want a hammer head that has a actually slightly radiused face. You want a curved face because it'll cause the steel to flow under it. Normally, I would recommend going out and finding an old hammer at a yard sale or something like that. But if you don't have that option, go to the hardware store, buy yourself a cheap Chinese import hammer, either a cross peen, a straight peen, or a drilling hammer. A drilling hammer has two relatively smooth faces and are easy to regrind into that nice, beautiful curve. You want a pretty gentle dome shape to it, and that will do a lot of your work for you. There's a specialty hammer that's made for farriers called a rounding hammer that has an almost flat face and a really domed face. It's sort of like a much bigger curved ball peen. Some ball peen machinist hammers have a really nice face on them. And a ball peen's handy to have anyway for a lot of stuff. So, now you've got something to hit with. Now you need something to hit on. Obviously, a big anvil is a really nice way to go. The general rule of thumb is typically about 50 to 100 pounds of anvil weight per pound of hammer. Now, anvils are expensive, and they're big, and they're heavy. And you really don't want to carry around a 400-pound anvil with you when you're trying to go camping. So, in an emergency situation, you're going to find something hard that you can smack on. Another case for another big rock. If you can find a big, smooth rock, is it going to do pretty work? No. Is it going to possibly chip and throw hunks of hard rock at you? Yes. Wear eye protection. Even sunglasses are better than nothing, but it doesn't hurt to have a set of safety glasses with you in your emergency kit. There's a lot of things working on cars and so on and so forth. It's just not a bad idea to have them. Some guys will have a chunk of railroad track. You can sometimes get a hunk of railroad track, say 18 inches long. Still difficult to pack in with, but if you've got it in the back of your truck, and you happen to be somewhere and need to do a little bit of quick fixing, it's a pretty serviceable tool. They've got a nice curved face on them so that it makes drawing out points really easy, but it also makes doing straight work very difficult. Some guys will use a chunk of I-beam. Some guys get a block of steel a couple inches square on the side. And honestly, you can do an awful lot with a 3-inch cube of steel or a 1.5-inch thick by 3-inch by 3-inch cube of steel. Doesn't look like a whole lot. Fairly weighty, but it will get you through an awful lot in the field. Obviously, you want to radius the corners off on it so you're not carrying around, you know, four really sharp edges on the top edges and so on and so forth. A little bit of work with a grinder and a file, and you'll be okay. If you have the option, there is an impromptu anvil with you quite a lot of the time when you're camping. I don't really recommend this for a whole lot of work for the reason it's going to strip the chrome off it, and it does have the potential to damage it. But in an emergency, I have used the ball hitch on my vehicle before to do minor repair work with. However, if you have a spare ball with you that's intended just for this purpose, the balls, the old-style balls that have the flat top on them, actually make a pretty serviceable anvil in the field for light work. Are you going to make a big crowbar or a huge Gates of Versailles kind of thing with it? No, you are not. However, for fixing things, you know, straightening out tent stakes and so on and so forth, it's pretty serviceable. So, that's your basic tooling, and it's very basic. This is very primitive tooling. This is very, very, very primitive work that we're describing in this particular show. I'll come back in later shows and get into more in-depth stuff down the road. But for now, I'm going to take a break. We're going to play some music, and then when I come back, I'll tell you some stories and give you some more basic tips and things like that that hopefully help you out. And you can enjoy International Blacksmith Day.
That sounds like a loop. Yeah, that's a loop. I must have fired their drummer. Uh-oh. It's ominous. Spooky. Yeah, this is about as spooky as my grandmother's underwear. Oh, these musicians, I bet they're going to try and follow it up with something really clever.
Guarded day and night behind these huge steel doors, I found a treasure house of music.
Oh, that was so clever. And then they added surf guitar. Oh, boy. What's next?
The sound engineer is ready.
You mean the Allison engineer? That could fool me.
The musicians are set.
Yeah, they're all smoking dope.
And I see a record made.
Heard you found a brand new heartbeat.
I don't really understand these so-called musicians. I mean, they want to be taken seriously. They want their music to come out and show their talent. Well, how can you take them seriously? They don't make any real money. They don't have jobs. And talent? Hey, go and see talent. Come over to my house. Watch my kids play rock band.
Have fun with your brand new hobby. Don't complain you're always broke. Think of all that wasted money. Maybe you should buy a boat.
Yeah, just think you could have a little sail cat or something sweet like that.
Another cultural landslide. I know I've used that in another show, but somehow Brand New Hobby just seemed like it fit really well, considering this is going to end up being a new hobby for some folks out there. Like any hobby, you're going to get into this, or as you get into this, you're going to have to do a lot of learning, a lot of educating yourself. There's a tremendous amount of resources on the net. There's a lot of great books out there. There's a few books that come up constantly that I don't recommend for your first book starting out. I started out with Alex Beeler's The Art of the Blacksmith. And while it has quite a bit of good information in it, some of it also is a little... it's available through Dover. It's worth having, but The Making of Tools, and I forget the name of the author right off the top of my head. I will have to look that one up. And that might be Weiger, too. Let me go look real quick. I love my bookshelf. Alexander G. Weiger. W-E-Y-G-E-R-S. The book has probably been out of print for ages. It's available through Amazon and several other retailers used. About $8 or so. He did The Making of Tools and The Modern Blacksmith both. Of the two books, The Modern Blacksmith is a better choice, and I apparently loaned my copy to somebody, so I can't tell you all of what it contains. The Making of Tools is also a good volume. If you have an option between the two, The Modern Blacksmith is going to be more useful to you. My book will be out probably 2013. We're working on a DVD series also, and that'll be available probably starting in late 2012. And I'll announce it here because I'm a shameless self-promoter. So there's a whole lot of books out there. And books, if you learn from books, there's a lot available. If you learn from visual things, there's a lot up on YouTube. And I can't be there with you to you know, hold your hand and say, yes, this is good, this is bad, that kind of thing. So use your common sense. Use all the other skills we've shown you in former episodes of A to Z to go through and figure out what is and isn't actually viable information. And the other thing is, a lot of people, the first thing they want to do, let's make a knife. Well, you know what? That's one of the more complicated things there is to make. So now that you've got all your stuff, you get that hot piece of steel, you're just raring to go, you got your new hobby, and you're going to run with it. Let's start out with a couple of really basic early on projects. The first thing to learn is how to straighten material. A nice bent up chunk of steel is not that useful until it's straightened out. So you lay it on your flat surface, anvil, you know, I-beam, railroad track, what have you. Get as much of it on the surface as you possibly can longwise. Hit the highest spot that sticks up with a hammer. That should help make it flatter. Keep turning it and hitting the high spots. Eventually it will flatten out. Now, to make a nice smooth curve, you're going to do almost exactly the opposite. Most people would immediately try and bend it, you know, turn it sideways and bend it over the side. That is more difficult. It takes a while to get used to that skill. But there's an easier way. To get a nice, long, smooth, even curve, like, say, for example, if you're going to make a steel rail for the bottom of a rocking chair, which I don't know why you would do that, but it's an example. Lay your flat piece of steel on the anvil, strike it on the face with your nice curved hammer. What happens is it compresses the steel under the impact point of the hammer, and the steel will sort of cup up toward it. You just keep walking down it, nice, even, light strokes. You don't have to get after this really hard. The reason you're heating material is to make it move easier, so you don't have to really wail on it with a 16-pound sledgehammer just to get it to move a little bit. What will happen is the steel will cup up toward the hammer. If you've got a thin, wide piece of steel, it will actually cup sideways just slightly, too. And this allows you to make a nice, even curve by just walking your hammer up it very slowly, each hammer strike overlapping with the one next to it. Accuracy with a hammer is something you'll have to work on a great deal. You'll spend about 5 years before you've got real good hammer control. And that's 20 to 50 hours a week of forge work before you're going to have really good hammer control. The rough rule of thumb is about 10,000 hours with the hammer in your hand before you've got a German level of hammer control. And that's just an entry journeyman level of hammer control. I mean, some guys can do some astonishing tricks early on because they're just naturals at it. Other guys, it takes even longer. You know, your mileage may vary. But this curving thing is actually a useful ability because in some cases, say you've got you're camping out, you've got a vehicle stuck. Having a slight curve on the end of a fairly large, heavy bar of steel will give you kind of a crowbar sort of tool, allowing you to help lift your car up out of the mud, muck, and crap it's in and get something underneath the tires, so on and so forth. So learning to make that curve is really useful, is really handy, and it's probably a really good idea. Once you've learned that skill, the next skill you need to learn is drawing down to a point. If you take, say a 3/8 inch round rod, heat it up, and smack it a couple of times with the hammer really good and hard, what you'll have will kind of look like a screwdriver. Right there on the very tip, and I mean very tip. The easiest way to do this is going to be to get it right up against the edge of your anvil and strike it so the hammer actually kind of bounces off and away. That way you're not smacking the face of the anvil, because smacking a hard hammer face against a hard anvil face does have the potential to chip one or the other. Having a big hunk of steel embedded in your skin is not a whole lot of fun. Go with me on this. I have a whole bunch of them. Ask me sometime. I can show them to you. And since we're on the tangendo coaster, you do have a lot of potential for injury. I've been injured an awful lot of times, some of them rather severely, some of them on film, which is even more fun. I've got a lot of little bits of steel in my skin from welding, from forge work, from metal dust collecting into my pores, so on and so forth. Here is a piece of information that you are not normally given. If you ever have to have done any kind of metal work like this and have to have an MRI done, magnetic resonance imaging done, absolutely request they x-ray your eyes to make sure there's no metal in your eyes. And if you've got any kind of metal in your body larger than, say, the tip of a ballpoint pen or right about there, let them know about it. The place where I went, they knew about things like, you know, if you have any kind of medical implants, that kind of stuff, they have to be careful because the magnet can cause them to move. You're in a very, very strong magnetic field. A big chunk of metal somewhere in your body is going to try and go to the center of that magnetic field, which is not going to be a good time. What we didn't know, what I was not told in advance, and what the tech had never seen happen before, is all those little tiny bits of metal in your skin won't come out, but they will heat up. It's a little bit like putting a fork in a microwave. You don't get the arcing lightning and all that kind of crap, but they do heat up quite a bit. They vibrate in the magnetic field and heat up. Magnetism works on the cube root law. Every time the mass increases by, the mass increases by 2, the magnetic attraction increases by 4 or something like that, or by a fact. You have to look up the cube root law. I can't remember exactly how it works right now because, you know, I have books for this. I pull out the math books and go, oh, this is what it is. So basically, very small pieces of metal won't come out of your skin, but they will heat up. When I got out of the MRI machine, I was covered in what looked like bee stings, little burns, thousands of little burns all over my skin. The next shower I took, my body shed probably a couple hundred of these little tiny ballpoint pen-sized pieces of steel that had been embedded in my skin over the previous 25 years. The couple of bigger pieces I've got in me still are relatively small, about the size of a pencil eraser. Those burn pretty good, and I was actually able to get those out also. I had a chunk of a hammerhead that was embedded in my forearm skin for some years where I'd smack two hammers together. You know, classic Mythbusters move. Even though Jamie couldn't get it to happen, I did. I managed to get a nice big chunk of steel embedded in my, fairly deep in my skin, and having been through the MRI, it worked out after a few more days, and that was kind of nice to get rid of, because I used to set off metal detectors. I still do sometimes. There's enough steel in my skin that I sometimes walk through a metal detector and it will go off, just because the overall mass of metal on me is, like I say, about an ounce, but it's mostly, you know, trapped in pores and things like that. It probably ain't healthy. I can say that much. You know, when you've got a pore that every time you go swimming, a little tiny trail of rust runs out of, that's an issue. So, you know, try not to do that. This is why we wear safety gear. And this is why you really don't want those things in your face. You know, you don't really want, you know, a hot bit of steel somewhere in an eye. So, you know, wear your stuff. Anyway, drawing points. Back off the tangent coaster. I hope everybody kept their hands and feet inside, you know. When you get that piece heated up, you hit it first on one face, you turn it 90 degrees to the left or right, doesn't matter, hit it again. Keep turning it back and forth each time you strike, and instead of getting that fanned-out screwdriver head shape, which can be really useful for prying on stuff and making a screwdriver when you need one, it will draw down into a little spike point. And the more comfortable you get with your hammer control, the more comfortable you get with the process, the easier it will be to draw that down into a spike, which is basically how you kind of make, you know, nails in the field. Commercial nails are manufactured by a machine, but it used to be all the nails were handmade. There was an era during the American settling era, you know, the Old West kind of era, when the nails were so freaking expensive, it was easier to burn down a building, go through the ashes afterwards, rake up all the nails, and take them with you than it was to get new nails. It wasn't super common, but it was done at least a few times enough that it was written down as an anecdotal bit of information. So, learning to make nails is not a bad thing, because it's a skill you can use for a lot of stuff. An awful lot of blacksmith projects start out with that point. And this is all stuff that's a lot easier to see done. So hop on YouTube and just Google blacksmith drawing a point, and it will help you much better visualize what's going on. And who knows, you might even see some of my videos up there. I don't have a whole lot right up right now, but down the road here in the not terribly distant future, there's going to be a whole lot of stuff coming up. So, let's see, I've only got about a little less than 10 minutes left before the end of the show here. So I'm just going to touch very briefly on other skills. Straightening, drawing points. The reverse of drawing points is making it thicker, which is upsetting. When you're doing your research, you'll need these terms to look for the different skills and techniques and so on and so forth. Upsetting is using the hammer or the anvil to make the end of a bar thicker. Useful for making ball ends on things like tongs and so on and so forth. Sometimes you have to upset in the middle of a bar before you make a bend so there's enough metal to make a square bend. Bending is obviously one of the skills you'll need. Twisting. This is mostly ornamental for all practical purposes, but it does have a lot of uses. Twisting is heating a bar, putting it in a vise, grabbing it with something like tongs, and rotating the bar around so that it creates a spiral twist. Now, a lot of guys tend to twist too cold. Most of your work is done up into the oranges. As the steel cools, it gets a lot more difficult to work. It gets a lot harder to make it maneuver and do what you want it to. And in some cases, you'll actually damage the steel if you work too cold. This is why I don't recommend stainless as a starter, because stainless is very easy to damage. But when you're twisting, you want to work up in a high yellow, real bright, high temperature, 1700-1800 degrees. It twists better. It's easier on the steel. It's just overall a good idea. Punching holes is another technique you'll need to learn, because it's real handy for field work. And I guess, you know, looking at how little actually got covered in this one, we're going to go through and do more episodes of this down the road, intermixed with all the other basic skills we cover in A to Z. And because we had just barely scratched the foundations of this. Basically, blacksmithing is one of the foundational skills of civilization. The ability to take metal and manufacture the tools that the other trades, the other craftsmen need to build the world that we know and understand is really incredibly useful, incredibly handy. Even if you've only got a basic rough knowledge of it and can just kind of fake it a little bit to fix a bent shaft in the field or something like that, it's just a good skill to have. There's probably not going to be a whole lot of time for stories and stuff before we get out of here, so just a quick one. We were out baling hay. I was probably early 20s or so, and the pin came out somewhere in the field on the hay wagon. The hay wagon got free, took off, and wandered away on its own. It crashed into a tree, bending the tongue fairly badly. We ended up building a pretty big fire in a steel bucket lined with clay. A buddy of mine was standing there going, "This isn't going to work, this isn't going to work." And I says, "Look, this is what I do. I can do this." So we built a fire in a bucket forge, using, oddly enough, the exhaust off the pickup truck as the air drive. Didn't work that good. But because the exhaust had too much, you know, too little oxygen in it and that kind of stuff. But we tried it. It didn't work. We just said, screw it, good enough. And fanned the end of the pipe, stuck a funnel in it, fanned the end of the pipe. Finally got it up to a nice, you know, medium orange, about the color of you know, orange soda orange. Drove it back into shape with a hammer. It certainly wasn't pretty, but it was better than it had been. We let it cool instead of quenching it with water because it would have made it more brittle and more apt to break. We let it cool slowly. Couldn't find the pin. We found a railroad spike stuck in a tree that we pried out and using our little bucket forge, hammered down into a retaining pin for the trailer, and got our load of hay out of there about 4 hours late. You know, it was kind of sucked to be working in the dark, but we got it done. And probably there were other ways to have done some of those things. We could have left the field and went and got a bolt or something like that. But, you know, sometimes it's the challenge that makes it fun. But he was certainly impressed as all snot that I could use a hammer in free air and a fire built out of just sticks and some bits of wood and whatnot, some 2x4s and all that. So anyway, there's the story for the day. I'm going to do more episodes of this because I just need to. There's too many other stories to cover, and I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank you for riding the Tangino coaster, and I'm going to leave you with my buddy Rob doing his cover of Rush's The Necromancer. And the earlier piece was ACL, who you can find on Alone Tone. You can find them at Another Cultural Landslide on AloneTone.com. Rob's stuff I'll have links up for on the Facebook page. So there you go. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. Hopefully you'll have a great Memorial weekend. To all the veterans out there, I want to thank you very much. You people are my heroes. So thank you.